Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine for a second that you are holding the master architectural blueprint for a massive, heavily customized house.
Okay, like a really complex set of plans.
Right. Now, normally, if a single page of that blueprint goes missing, the outcome is frustrating, sure, but it's somewhat predictable. Like, maybe the guest bathroom just doesn't get built.
Or a staircase suddenly leads to nowhere.
Exactly. You lose a very specific function. But what if tearing a tiny corner off page one results in a house missing its entire roof, while tearing that exact same size corner off, say, page 10, results in a house where the plumbing is wildly overgrown, just bursting through the walls and flooding the foundation?
Wow. So the structural integrity of the entire project would just completely collapse, but it depends purely on the location of the tear rather than the actual size of it.
Which brings us to the core question of this deep dive. Because if we apply this blueprint analogy to your own DNA, it perfectly frames this massive biological mystery. How can a single gene mutation, like literally a typo in the exact same stretch of genetic code, how can that cause two entirely distinct, devastating developmental disorders?
Right.
How does the outcome depend solely on where the typo occurs within that single gene?
Yeah, the clinical term for this is a location-dependent phenotype.
Yeah.
And honestly, it represents one of the most complex, just head-scratching puzzles in neurodevelopmental research today.
I can imagine.
I mean, when the same genetic blueprint causes completely different structural and cognitive outcomes in a developing human, it throws our standard diagnostic models into absolute chaos.
No, you wouldn't even know what you're looking at.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And solving this specific mystery goes far beyond just a purely academic exercise. It has profound real-world implications for families out there who are desperately navigating the medical system, you know, just looking for an accurate diagnosis for their children.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because a biological mystery of this scale, it doesn't get solved by just one researcher looking through a single microscope. It takes a massive, globally coordinated effort to gather that kind of data.
Oh, absolutely. Today, we celebrate the work of Anne Greger, Rebecca Flory, Maria Coltane, and the massive international network of researchers across institutions like the University of Bern and Radboud University Medical Center, who have advanced our understanding of neurodevelopmental disorders.
Yeah, an incredible team. And to really grasp what they uncovered, we have to start by getting to know the gene at the center of the deep dive. It's called LDB1, which stands for Limb Domain Binding Protein 1.
That's right, LDB1.
And looking through the structural data, the best way I can think to describe the LDB1 protein to you is that it acts like the ultimate molecular party promoter.
I like that analogy.
Right, because it doesn't actually bind to the DNA itself to turn genes on or off. Like, it's not the one playing the music. Instead, it acts as the central organizational hub, bringing together all the other proteins that actually do the binding.
Yeah, the molecular biology strongly supports that.
Yeah.
So LDB1 is known as a scaffolding protein. Its primary job is to physically bridge distant parts of the genome by holding different regulatory proteins together in a really stable complex.
Got it.
And to understand how it organizes this cellular party, you really have to visualize its anatomy.
Yeah.
LDB1 essentially operates using two main interaction domains. Think of them as two very different sets of hands.
Okay, two sets of hands.
Right. So on one side, you have the N-terminal dimerization domain, or the DD. This specific region allows the LDB1 protein to hold hands with another copy of itself.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a process known as homodimerization.
So it basically pairs up with a twin to form a really stable foundational base.
Exactly. The stability of that homodimer is crucial. Then, on the completely opposite end of the protein, you have the C-terminal limb interaction domain, or the LID.
And that's the other hand?
Right. This is the hand that reaches outward to grab onto other specific partner proteins in the cell, such as a really crucial transcription factor called LHX2.
LHX2, okay.
Yeah, and we call this heterodimerization. So when you have this massive complex, fully assembled LDB1 bound to itself at the base and bound to its working partners at the top, it acts as a master regulator.
For regulator for what, exactly?
For critical stages of embryonic brain development, neurogenesis, and even the structural formation of other major organs.
Wow. So if that complex is so essential, any disruption is obviously going to cause major issues. And historically, the medical community only knew about a tiny handful of mutations in this specific gene, right?
Yes, very few are documented.
And crucially, those known mutations were all located right at that C-terminal end, the LID hand that grabs the partner proteins. And the patients with those specific mutations presented with a condition called congenital ventriculomegaly.
Right, which is quite severe. Ventriculomegaly is an anatomical anomaly where the fluid-filled spaces deep inside the brain, the ventricles, become abnormally enlarged.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the cerebrospinal fluid builds up, which can put just immense pressure on the developing brain tissue. It's a very clear, structurally visible phenotype on an MRI.
But the mystery at the heart of this deep dive really started when the researchers gathered a new cohort of 16 individuals from clinics all over the world.
Right.
Because these patients didn't just have mutations at the C-terminal end. They had genetic variants scattered across the entire LDB1 gene. And their clinical symptoms were wildly variable.
Which is the puzzling part.
Exactly. Some had that severe brain fluid buildup, but others just had general developmental delays, speech issues, or behavioral anomalies like autism spectrum traits and hyperactivity.
Yeah.
Some had skeletal issues, others had vision impairments. It looked like a completely different disease depending on the patient.
And facing that kind of clinical scatter, it requires stepping back and asking a fundamental diagnostic question.
What's that?
Well, you have 16 patients with typos in the exact same genetic blueprint. Are we looking at one highly variable, totally unpredictable disease? Or are we actually looking at two completely different diseases that are just masquerading as one under the same gene name?
And to prove that the physical location of the mutation dictates the disease, the researchers had to build a massive multi-pronged methodology. Like, they didn't just look at the clinical data.
Yeah, they had to go much deeper.
Right. They ran in silico structural computer models to see how the protein folds. They tested human kidney cells, specifically HEK293 cells, in vitro to watch the proteins interact. Mm. And finally, they used in vivo animal models. But I actually have to stop you there and push back on one specific part of this methodology.
Okay, go for it.
Why use fruit flies, Drosophila melanogaster, to study complex human brain development? Now, you and I both know the fruit fly is a workhorse for basic genetics.
Yeah.
But we're talking about human ventriculomegaly-like complex fluid buildup in human brain cavities, along with human intellectual disability. A fly doesn't have human brain architecture.
That's a fair point.
So how does knocking down a gene in a fly give you any reliable data for that specific anatomical and cognitive outcome? Like, exactly how does that translate?
Yeah, the skepticism is completely warranted there when you're trying to map something as complex as human brain architecture onto an insect. But the key here isn't that the fly has ventricles. It doesn't.
Right.
The key is that the molecular machinery driving the cellular development is incredibly ancient. The fruit fly possesses a gene called CHI, or CHIP, which is the highly conserved ortholog to our human LDB1 gene.
Oh, okay.
Overall, it shares a 59% sequence identity with the human gene. But when you look specifically at those two critical interaction domains, the DD and LID hands we talked about, the evolutionary conservation is much, much higher.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The proteins are essentially performing the exact same biochemical scaffolding job in a developing fly nervous system as they do in a human embryo.
So the researchers aren't looking for enlarged brain ventricles in the fly. They're looking for fundamental breakdowns in how the nervous system functions and survives when that scaffolding collapses.
Exactly. The assays they used were highly specific to neurodevelopmental function. After using co-immunoprecipitation in the human cells to prove whether the mutant proteins could physically bind to their partners.
Right, checking if the hands still work.
Exactly. They moved to the flies to measure the physiological fallout. They tested overall viability, like did the flies even survive development? And they ran negative geotaxis assays.
What does that involve?
It involves tapping the flies to the bottom of a vial and measuring how successfully they climb up 8 centimeters in 10 seconds. It's a very reliable way to test motor neuron function and climbing ability.
I read they even monitored their sleep architecture, which completely blew my mind. They put the flies in these tiny individual transparent tubes equipped with infrared beams to track every single movement they made over several days.
Yeah, the sleep tracking is fascinating because sleep disturbances are an incredibly massive component of human neurodevelopmental disorders. They affect a huge percentage of patients.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So having a model organism where you can manipulate a single gene and watch the direct result on sleep consolidation It gives you an incredibly powerful toolkit to isolate exactly what these different mutations are doing.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting. When they looked at the cellular data, a massive paradox popped out regarding those C-terminal variants, the ones associated with the severe brain fluid buildup.
Oh, the frameshifts.
Yeah. Some of these mutations were frameshift variants. If you think of DNA like a sentence, a frameshift is when a letter gets deleted, shifting the entire reading frame so the rest of the sentence turns into complete gibberish.
Right. It ruins everything downstream.
Exactly. It creates a weird scrambled tail on the protein. Now, normally you'd expect the cell to just, you know, destroy a broken protein like that, but instead these mutations actually increase the amount of LDB1 protein floating around in the cell.
It's totally counterintuitive.
And these mutant proteins started clumping together, forming these strange non-nucleolar aggregates in the nucleus of the cell. So my question is, how does more protein equal a worse clinical outcome?
That is the million-dollar question. And the answer lies in a failure of the cell's internal garbage disposal system.
Okay, go on.
Specifically, a process called ubiquitination. Usually, when a protein is damaged or have outlived its usefulness, the cell attaches a tiny molecular tag to it called ubiquitin.
Like a barcode.
Yes, exactly like a barcode. That tag signals the proteasome, which is the garbage disposal, to chop the protein up and clear it out. But by scrambling the tail end of the LDB1 protein, the frameshift mutation accidentally erased the specific lysine residues where that ubiquitin tag is supposed to attach.
Oh, wow. So the garbage disposal doesn't even know the broken protein is there. It's completely invisible to the cleanup crew.
Exactly. The mutant protein evades degradation entirely. It just builds up and builds up and eventually starts clumping together into those toxic aggregates you mentioned.
That sounds disastrous.
It is. But to fully understand why this causes such severe developmental damage, we really have to contrast it with the other side of the protein. Let's break down the pathomechanism of the N-terminal variants, the ones in the DD region.
Right. So going back to our earlier analogy, this is the hand that holds onto its twin to form the stable base.
Yes. And when the team ran the in silico structural modeling on these N-terminal variants, like one specific mutation called PR131TRP, they saw something fascinating.
What did they see?
Replacing just a single amino acid in that region introduced a bulky, really awkward molecular structure. This completely destroyed the stabilizing polar interactions that the protein needs to bind to itself.
So the hand basically can't hold on anymore.
Right, the protein essentially loses its grip. Because it can't form that stable homodimer base, it creates what geneticists call a loss of function effect, or haploinsufficiency.
Because you inherit two copies of every gene, right? One from each parent. So if one copy has this N-terminal mutation, it's just broken and useless.
Exactly. The body's expecting a certain amount of functional protein, but it's only getting half. If we go back to your party promoter analogy, a loss of function variant is like the promoter simply calling in sick.
Okay, I can picture that.
The party still happens because there's another promoter there to help, but it's disorganized, maybe a bit slow, and lacks coordination.
And that matches the clinical phenotype perfectly, because the patients with these N-terminal loss of function variants, they present with general developmental delays and intellectual disability.
Yeah.
The brain architecture is generally intact. There's crucially no ventriculomegaly. The system is just functioning at a lower capacity. And the FLY data backed this up, right?
He did.
When they intentionally overexpressed this broken N-terminal variant in the flies, it didn't cause any severe toxicity. The flies survived fine because a broken, useless protein just sits there doing nothing.
Exactly. The C-terminal variants, however, they operate on a completely different, much more destructive pathomechanism.
These are the LID region ones.
Right. The mutations in the LID region that grab the partner proteins like LHX2, these cause a dominant negative effect. Think of this mutant protein not as broken and useless, but as an active poison pill.
So extending the analogy, this isn't the party promoter calling in sick. This is the promoter showing up to the venue highly intoxicated and aggressive.
That is the perfect extension of the metaphor. The dominant negative protein can still bind to itself at the base, and it can still reach out and grab its partner protein, LHX2.
Oh, so it still goes to work.
Right. It goes through all the motions of forming the scaffolding complex. But because its tail end is scrambled and it's evading the garbage disposal, once it grabs the healthy partner protein, it ruins the function of the entire complex. It literally traps the healthy proteins in those toxic nuclear aggregates.
It actively sabotages the healthy proteins it interacts with. It's not just missing, it's tearing down the work of the healthy copy.
Yes. The mutation dominates the healthy version, and the outcome is incredibly negative. Because it's actively toxic, the phenotype in the patients is vastly more severe. This is where you see the congenital ventriculomegaly. But the damage extends far beyond the brain. These patients present with severe motor delays, profound hearing and vision loss, and major structural anomalies in other organs entirely, like the heart, the kidneys, and the gastrointestinal tract.
Man, and that completely explains the fly data as well. Because when the researchers overexpressed these specific C-terminal variants in the flies, it was catastrophically toxic.
Yes, extremely toxic.
It significantly reduced their overall viability, and it completely wrecked their climbing ability in the negative geotaxis assay. It was measurably worse than if the gene had just been deleted entirely.
Yeah, the multi-layered approach of this methodology is what makes the conclusion so robust. They linked the structural folding of the protein to the cellular aggregates, matched that to the behavioral toxicity in the fly, and finally mirrored that perfectly with the severe clinical symptoms in the human patients.
So what does this all mean? We've walked through some incredibly elegant, highly complex molecular biology. But if you are a listener trying to ground this in human reality, how does proving these two distinct mechanisms actually change the day-to-day life of a patient sitting in a genetic counseling clinic?
Well, the discovery revolutionizes their clinical care by introducing true predictive medicine.
How so?
Before this research, if a child's genetic sequencing came back with a mutation on the LDB1 gene, a doctor would be looking at a terrifyingly broad spectrum of possibilities. They wouldn't know if the child was going to have a speech delay or severe cardiac and brain malformations. Now, they have direct clinical utility based purely on the variant's location.
So the blueprint tells them exactly what kind of damage to look for.
Precisely. If a child has an N-terminal variant, the clinical team knows they are likely looking at general developmental delays. They can immediately focus their resources on early intervention, speech therapy, and behavioral support.
That's a huge relief.
It is. Crucially, they know they likely do not need to subject that child and their parents to aggressive, terrifying monitoring for severe heart defects or brain fluid buildup.
Wow.
However, if the sequencing shows a C-terminal variant, the doctors know immediately to order an MRI to screen for ventriculomegaly, to bring in a cardiologist to check the heart, and to prepare the family for a much more severe anatomical trajectory. It replaces uncertainty with a clear clinical roadmap.
That level of clarity is just life-changing for a family navigating a rare disease. But we always have to remember that science is an evolving process, right? It's not a finish line.
Very true.
And the researchers were very transparent about the limitations of this study. Like, gathering 16 individuals for an ultra-rare genetic disorder is a monumental achievement, but in the grand scheme of statistics, it's still a very small cohort.
Absolutely. You cannot draw absolute, immovable diagnostic lines in the sand with only 16 patients. And it's vital to acknowledge that biology is inherently messy. Not every single variant fit perfectly into these two neat categories.
Yeah.
For instance, they found one N-terminal variant known as PARG181GLN that showed highly mixed results.
Yeah, I noticed that in the data. Because in the in silico structural models, that specific mutation didn't completely destroy the protein's ability to grip itself. It just weakened it slightly.
And when they tested it in the fly models, it didn't cause the typical severe effects you'd expect from a full loss of function. Because the data is conflicting, that specific mutation currently remains a VUS, a variant of unknown significance.
Right.
It serves as an important reminder that while we have mapped the two major mechanisms, there is still nuance within the protein structure that we just don't fully understand yet.
Looking toward the future, the next steps outlined in the deep dive are fascinating, particularly going back to those sleep disturbances in the fruit flies.
Yeah, that part is really exciting.
Because the researchers noticed that when they knocked down the Qi gene, specifically in the glial cells, which are the critical support cells in the brain, it promoted a hypersomnia-like state in the flies. They had heavily consolidated, unusually long sleep episodes.
Identifying the glial cells as the driver for that sleep phenotype is a massive finding. If you look at the human data, sleep architecture issues are incredibly prevalent in neurodevelopmental disorders, affecting up to 86% of individuals.
86%, that's huge.
It is. And chronic sleep disruption exacerbates cognitive delays and behavioral issues. So the next major step for this research is to investigate whether these specific glial mechanisms in the fly translate to the sleep disturbances seen in human patients with LDB1 mutations.
If they do.
If we can isolate the cellular mechanism causing the sleep disruption, we might eventually be able to target it with therapeutics.
It is genuinely staggering how much life-altering information is packed into the microscopic folding of a single gene. I mean, we started by looking at a tiny missing piece of an architectural blueprint, and we've mapped the consequences all the way from molecular garbage disposals to brain ventricles down to the sleeping patterns of fruit flies. As we wrap up this deep dive, could you summarize the ultimate takeaway for the listener?
Mutations in the LDB1 gene cause two overlapping but distinct neurodevelopmental disorders, depending entirely on their location. And terminal variants result in a loss of function leading to general developmental delays, while C-terminal variants exert a toxic, dominant negative effect that causes more severe anatomical issues like enlarged brain ventricles. What does this mean for our understanding of other single-gene diagnoses? Could many of them secretly be hiding multiple distinct syndromes that require completely different clinical treatments?
This episode was based on an open-access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now, stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Under white light, the quiet code begins to bend. A single letter slips, and everything depends. Same name on the page, but not the same effect. Two endings of the story in the architect. If it breaks at the front, the partners fall apart. If it shifts at the tail, it rewrites the heart. I'm tracing where it lands like sparks on a map. Watching shadows gather in the synaptic gap. Two ends of the same thread, pulling in the dark. One turns down the volume, one strikes a louder spark. Where you cut the pattern changes what it means. In the brain's deep waters and the hospital screens. Two ends of the same thread, now we can see. Thank you.